Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. This episode is a 10-page podcast all about one of his short stories. Get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks and a special combined podcast of Rosa Remarks. This is going to be a very special episode, listeners. It is our only real opportunity to cover one story that's going to apply to both podcasts. So welcome, welcome. I am so excited to be talking about, this is a short story we've got here, but I think the discussion is going to be pretty meaty. And to have a good conversation about such a notable story as the Pied Piper of Duckburg is, I need a guest who is ready to engage with both versions of the story. And so welcome back for the first time on Rosa Remarks, but welcome again to Barks Remarks to Niels Lidhjort. Thank you so much, Niels, for joining me.
Thank you. I'm delighted and honored.
Wonderful. So I got to have you join me for an episode of Barks Remarks. As I said, we got to have a great conversation about the adventure-length story, A Spicy Tale. But that one, we recorded it fairly far in advance. So this episode is actually likely to come out a little bit before. That one's not too far away, but even though we've already recorded, this is likely to be the listener's first time hearing you as a guest. And so my understanding is you are, first off, you are based in, you're based in Norway, where these Indeed. Comics are much more popular, right?
Yes.
And then you are, in addition to being a professor of mathematics, statistical probability, you've done a lot of commentary in the Scandinavian market for some of these stories, right?
Yes, I've written a couple of, or possibly 7 out of 9 total prefaces and lurid introductions to Barks volumes and Rosa volumes, etc. And a few of them have been translated into Danish and Swedish.
Right. So that's some great credentials for joining in this conversation. But honestly, the best credentials, I think, is just being a longtime fan of the stories, right?
Well, yes.
That is the unifying element for most of my guests, with the exception of a few newbies.
By all means.
And I do like to ask guests, I invite them to maybe talk about how they got into the comics, but that's just a little less relevant for people from Scandinavia, where it's almost as common as breathing.
Yes, and I would say it would be pretty hard and pretty strange not to be exposed to the Duck comics at all. Then you need to belong to a slightly strange stratum of society.
Right.
At least exactly. Speaking about my generations in the 1960s and so on and so on, because it was everywhere and it was discussed in schools and so on and so on. So it was so pervasive that you couldn't really avoid it.
Right. Yeah. It's my understanding that, you know, it is not as common and not as popular in the modern era.
No. So I do think that it goes reasonably well, but they are struggling, the publishers, to keep it in mind and to do the famous translation from parents to children, which was pretty automatic in the past, but now it's not, surprise, as automatic as in the past. So we don't know where we're headed. So it's a downward curve, but not yet hitting zero or hitting American parameter values.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, with my American guests, it makes much more sense to talk about how is it that you happened to become such a big fan of these stories.
Yes,
But of course, the internet kind of culture has made things so diffuse and granular that it's understandable. But maybe I will invite you to mention one or two of your favorite stories. I do think that's always a fun thing to share. Oh, and you know what? I should have prepared you for this. But we're going to be talking about a Gyro Gearloose 8-pager, which is kind of a special class of those stories. Are you fond of those short gyro stories? Do you have any
fondness for any of those? Yes, I do understand that some people and some fans, they say, okay, they are nice, but not as nice as the famous 10 pages and the one shots. And I understanding that, of course. But for me, the four-page Gyaro stories in the Scrooge comics are wonderful and inspiring and so on and so on. And I also like the 8 pages. There are not so many of them, and they're not all uniformly fantastic, so to speak, but I do very much like them. And I would have missed them if they were somehow to be withdrawn from the equations.
Yeah,
and I think it's a good start for the Pied Piper story, because this is not a Scrooge or Donald story at all. It's the main character, after all, is Gyaro and the little helper, actually.
Right. Yeah, and it's nice to get to do an episode where we do dwell on Gyaro Gearloose, because yes. I spend so much time talking about Karl Barth's most famous creation, Uncle Scrooge.
Yes.
But that does short shrift to the fact that he created, you know, Gyaro has also had his own comic book series, a little more limited.
Yes, but I like him and love him. I think it's a fantastic creation, and it's... he's spanning more dimensions. So Duckburg would surely not be quite the same without him. And
I agree.
Same for the zillions of readers.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Gyaro Gearloose, the madcap inventor, would alone have kind of made Barks, you know, well-regarded among Disney creators. Mm. He's probably got to be Barks' second most, notable character that he created. I feel like Gladstone Gander is kind of in the running, but Gladstone never had his own comic line, you know?
Well, of course, we do have the Beagle Boys, too.
Yeah, we do have the Beagle Boys, who've also had their own comic line in the day.
So. We do have Magica the Spell. So mm-hmm. There is a certain... It's a good list of extra characters by all means, but Gyaro is absolutely close to my imagination and inspiration.
And you know, Niels, what was really interesting for me when I got involved in this big podcast project, something that I learned, and now it's a fact that I love to mention to guests, is the whole reason, or a big part of the reason, for having these Gyaro Gearloose stories at the, you know, sort of at the end of the Uncle Scrooge stories is due to this really strange U.S. post office regulation.
Yes, very strange, yes.
So just in brief, at some point, it came down that Western Publishing did not receive the most favorable mailing rates for stories, for comics that only featured one character throughout. And so basically, by necessity, they had Barks doing these shorter Gyaro Gearloose stories to tag on to the end so that they could get this most favorable mailing rate, essentially.
Pretty strange and bizarre, but these things work in mysterious ways. So
it really is. So it is a shame. I definitely think there are some stories later on, that adventure stories, that maybe suffered from being a little bit too short. And that was by necessity. But it did give us these very memorable, as you say, they're not all the greatest, but there are some real classics in there. And I agree. It would have been a shame to not have this kind of catalog of Gyaro Gearloose stories as well.
On the other hand, not to make a too big point of this, it might be hard for us fans to imagine a 32-page story with Gyaro at the center of it all. It might be, of course, Barks could do so many things, so he could have carried that off too. But in our imagination, he is best for the shortish versions, not for the long, long, long stories.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Gyaro probably would wear out his welcome if he were on for longer than 8 to 10 pages or so.
Then he would have needed more surroundings and a woman close to him or whatever to make it sufficiently interesting to go into the longer things.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So let's see. Let's delve a little bit into this story and its background. First off, we are dealing with a story called The Pied Piper of Duckburg. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is dealing with the famous legend of the Pied Piper. Niels, do you mind giving us just a little bit of brief background?
Yes, I've read a couple of things regarding this, and it's an old, old story. This is medieval times. We're back to the 13th century. in Sachsen between Germany and Denmark, actually. But I think there are actually similar versions of the same theme if we delve into the background of the long classical stories being told across European nations. So the theme is pretty much captured by the first pages in the stories that we are going to do met, and it's about the rats and the rats' inventions and what happens. There is a piper playing his flute, drawing the rats away, but also in some versions of the story, drawing possibly the young boys and girls, and specifically the girls. So there are many versions of this. And of course, I couldn't resist this morning playing through one of the Hugo Wolf songs to the Goethe text. And in that particular Goethe poem, there is an added element about the fear of the people that the Pied Piper will run away with all the young women. So that's an additional element.
Yeah,
But
you did a good
it's one of
job.
these things which has existed for 800 years, and there's no unique start of this story. But it
Right.
tells something, and it has the characteristics that we can understand it at many levels, and we can live into the basics of the story, that something is bothering us, not only the single persons, but the full life in a little village, etc. So what do we do then? Panic, panic, and solution, solution, etc.
Right. I think that's a good synopsis of it. I think the important thing to know about the legend is just what you said. It is so old. It's one of the like it has to be one of the oldest kind of source materials for a Bark
Yes.
story. And people around the world are familiar with it. It's been parodied in so many different comics and cartoons. That you're almost certainly it's something that we use as a metaphor, right? Oh, it's time to pay the piper is a famous saying in English
Yes.
that refers to, paying an onerous bill when it comes due. Because I think that's one of the key elements is that the townspeople, once the rats are gone, they are in some tellings of it reluctant to actually pay the money. But the piper has this kind of great power, essentially.
Yes, so it's really about the mythic power and the magic of the flute. So the magic flute with
Right.
Mozart and so on and so on might also be part of the same legendary terrain.
Right.
So it's
So,
really the magic. He's not simply a good worker at his job as a rat person, but this added magical mythic mystery to it,
right.
complete with the flute.
But Barks is going to hang a pretty whimsical story, or at least the start of a very whimsical story around,
Yes.
because as we've alluded, this is an unfinished. I'm not sure I've mentioned it explicitly yet. The reason that we've got this unusual structure, and we're going to be talking about the version of this story that Don Rosa finished, as well as another Don, Don Yippas, eventually a
Indeed.
few years later, came around to take his own crack at finishing this story. So Barks had started this story in 1959, and he never got to finish it. We don't really know exactly where he wanted to go with it, because anyone he would have talked to about it that cared enough to remember the details, that wouldn't have happened until a couple of decades later.
Yes.
But basically, we get pencil drawings of the first three pages. And so it was up to another artist to finish the inking for those three pages and then take the next five pages, essentially, and
Yes.
try and come up with a convincing story to finish it off. And so here's what Barks said about it. Here's what we know. It's that in 1978, he exchanged a letter with the fan Michael Barrier. Yeah, so in a letter to Michael Barrier, he said that he quote, shelved the Pied Piper story with Gyro because I felt I was getting into something too involved for such a short story. Also, I would have to draw whole swarms of kids and rats and people, and the page rates weren't worth it.
So we may take that as fact or literary fact or a Barks quip or an incorrectly rendered piece of memory from his egg. So we shouldn't pay too much attention to these sentences.
Exactly.
So there might be other reasons, and we know that in 1959-1960, Barks was doing lots of things, and it's not at all surprising to imagine that he had various starting ideas that he scrapped.
Yeah, it's definitely something to take with a grain of salt. However, we do know from like his correspondence and recollections that he is often thinking about those page rates, right? I got to do Mythic Mystery recently, where one of his lavish splash panels was taken out, and that really devastated him.
Horrible. For him and for us, yes.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. And he has referenced, you know, how much time and how intense it was drawing some of those great money splashing around scenes. Yes. We know that he had Garay sometimes help him with the really involved art in those types of panels. So, you know, it seems at least plausible. I will note that in 1961, just a little bit later, he would kind of extensively draw rats in his story All at Sea, but he never put them in like a splash panel. So even though that did have a lot of rats in the story, there were never that many of them at one time.
But one of the footnotes that we might make here comes to mind, namely Scrooge number 9, where famously in Norway, they went all the way to Herringtail in Norway.
Right.
And it's all the lemons, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands. So this particular aspect of Barks's mind and work did not stop him from having a couple of scenes with thousands and thousands of lemmings.
Right. So a different swarm of rodents.
Yes. So it could be, too. So that might be one of the smaller sub-reasons for me not to fully trust that statement 20 years later that was the reason for not finishing the story.
Alternatively, perhaps he just remembered drawing all those swarms of lemmings in Lemming with the Locket and was like, never again.
Why not? Yes.
It is interesting, though, that he mentions drawing swarms of kids, and that's something that we're not going to end up seeing in either of these versions. I think likely because that aspect of it does sound pretty sinister. It would be hard, I think, to do that without it maybe feeling a little uncomfortable.
That's of course, since we are free to speculate about other endings and other continuations of the three first Bark stories. So it's an opportunity for any of us with creative minds to think about other ways to pursue. And some of these other ways to pursue this start of the story would be to bring in the more sinister things about flocks of kids being drawn by the mythical magic of the flute.
So my recollection, Niels, is that this was done through the Dutch publisher, but it was in fact commissioned, as it were, by Bruce Hamilton, you know, under kind of the Gladstone publishing regime.
And this is also interesting, pretty early in Don Rosa's career.
Right.
This is really one of the start years. So this is one of the first things he did. So it was published in 1990, and I read somewhere that he was asked in 1988. So he did this during 1989, and then it was published the year after. So again, it's one of the earliest stories.
And so let's go ahead and transition to talking about that first version. I guess that the first thing to really focus on is just what in this story is pure Barks, right? The story, the three pencil pages, which if anyone wants to see the pencil pages, I believe that they're available in the Karl Barks Library that was published, you know, in the early 80s. They can also be seen near the end of volume 2 of the Fantagraphics Don Rosa Library, or whoever published that in your, you know, in your own region.
So as a footnote to that, I have two very nice editions in front of me in Norwegian, namely one of the Hall of Fame books, where we see these three pages, and also the collective works of Karl Barks in 30 volumes, and then we see the Barks sketches.
Right. And I think that these first three pages stand out to me as like pretty strong.
Yes.
It's a really, I think it's a really good start. It's a really good setup for this story. And it's very engaging with some really fun, whimsical moments kind of packed
Absolutely,
in there.
yes.
As you say, this is a Gyro story. He is the protagonist and it's centered around him. And it has him basically peddling his inventions on his little invention push cart. This is an aspect of Gyro that I just love, that he is kind of this little small businessman making these just incredible and ridiculous contraptions, but pushing them out of his little workshop or out of his little push cart.
Yes, and it's a lovely way to start a story.
It
so
really
in a
is.
Couple of pages we are into the direction of the story,
right? And this does a good job too of setting up both of our characters, right? Because Barks is going to code Gyro as this like eccentric inventor, and then we get to see as he passes beneath Uncle Scrooge's money bin, we get a very quick snappy setup of Scrooge McDuck, because Gyro refers to him as the richest duck in the world.
Yes, as we might need being reminded of that.
Right.
But that's I think it's pretty classic that he puts in these things for the potential segments of readers not super familiar with everything. So it's a wise little storytelling device without taking too much space. So why not?
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny to us longtime fans to think of Barks needing to reintroduce this character that we know inside out. But
yes.
But it is, you know, some segment of the monthly or weekly readership is seeing a character for the first time. So we get also a very brisk setup of the problem of the story, right? Scrooge invites Gyro in and explains to him that he's got rats in his money bin and is worried that they could chew up billions of dollars.
Yes.
And when Gyro supposes that he'd like him to build some rat traps, he says, no, in fact, I'd like you to take these rats and all the rats in Duckburg clear away from here. So that's it. That's our setup for the story. And it's a great way to kind of veer into that Pied Piper.
Yes. And we might pause for 20 seconds to wonder and to admire, what is it? It's picture number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with the dancing rats in the bin. It's ridiculous and fantastic. It's one of these classic Barks things that he sees, and it doesn't disturb the story in a way, but it's such a lovely little detail. The happy dancing rats.
I agree.
I like
I'm
it.
Glad you pointed that out, because it's certainly one of the best panels. they're hilarious and they're very cute. Barks is good. I think about the ones in All at Sea as well. Barks likes to draw his vermin very cute sometimes, not gross or not menacing.
Cute rats.
Yeah, they're adorable. And so at this point in the story, Gyro is going to kind of get the invention that he uses to think of inventions. It is, what does he call it, Snails?
No, it's a pretty nice page 2. And of course, we could have had the story evolving without page 2. But in page 2, he consults something resembling ChatGPT, because he forms a question and out pops the answer beautifully. So it's another pretty strange, hilarious thing.
It is hilarious.
With a little helper. So the little helper is ChatGPT, anno 1960.
I adore this little gag here. I think it's set up so well and it's so funny. It's his electronic question answer. And it's just a little box with a bunch of circuits. And he is able to talk to it, kind of like ChatGPT. But then it's a very analog process where a little note
and the answer pops
out.
Yeah. And, on a piece of
and
paper.
So when he reads it, he says, the note says, to invent a cheese so tempting, the rats will follow you. Lead them like the Pied Piper across the Goose River, then blow up the bridge so they can't get back.
Yes.
And that's a really nice setup for the rest of the story. Even though Barks never did finish it, it does feel like there should be a good story that will flow out of that.
Absolutely. So just a brief comment, because we are discussing not only the super famous Karl Barks and the super famous Don Rosen, but also the very famous Dan Yipes.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Yipes has a slight variation on this page, because the advice given by the magical chat GPT in that story says, lead them like the Pied Piper across the Goose River, then pay the bridge master, we're talking corruption, to raise the bridge to so they can't get back. So as, right. variation, as opposed to blowing it up, so it's an added element in the Dan Yipes version of this story,
yeah,
which he comes back to.
It is an interesting, so that is where the story is going to go. And you have to wonder, based on when Yipes did his version of the story, if there was maybe some discomfort. I'm guessing that there was probably some discomfort with the idea of even referencing blowing up the bridge.
Yes.
That's going to be a pretty funny comic beat in the Rosa story.
Absolutely.
And it's Rosa talks in his commentary about taking great pains to remain very faithful to Bark's sketch of the story, right? He only allowed himself just a little bit of variation. So let's see. Boy, there's a lot. There's just so much to cover in this short story. quick little divergence here, right? We've set this up as a Karl Barks sketched out germ of an idea of a story that Rosa finished. We haven't really mentioned too much Dan Yipes. It's going to be natural. I think the reason is because I have read the Don Rosa version of this story many times. It was published quite a bit earlier, right?
Yes, in 1990, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know when the first American edition was, but anyway, it's pretty early in Don's career. And many years before Dan Yipes published his in 2007, actually.
Right, exactly. So there's almost two decades separating them and a lot of reprints.
Yes.
Rosa, of course, is an extremely well-known Disney Comics artist from the U.S., from America. He is very famous. The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, of course, made him very famous. And he iterated on a lot of Barks stories. Dan Yipes is not as famous as Rosa, at least stateside, but he is definitely like the giant of Dutch Disney Comics publishing.
Yes.
He's an incredible artist who...
I like him very much.
Oh, yeah. I adore Dan Yipes. The covers that he did that were on many of these comics during the, you know, when Don Rosa was first publishing in the Gladstone comics, Dan Yipes was doing most of those, or at least half, I would say, of the covers that they would use for those. He definitely had some stories translated and published in America as well. But I would say over here, he's probably, at least at that time in the late 80s, early 90s, he was probably as known in the States for his covers as he was for his stories.
Yes, that would be true. Absolutely.
So Dan Yipes and Holland, the Netherlands, really bats above their weight as a fairly small story with a lot of legendary Disney comics writers.
By all means.
So he is, at least if you're in the Netherlands, he's as well regarded, if not more well regarded, than Don Rosa. So it makes sense, I think, that he would be commissioned to do this. And of course, like Rosa, he was heavily involved with kind of following up with Bark's works, because he did a lot of the Junior Woodchuck stories. He redid the art for many of those. So anyway, that's kind of our side note. We'll talk about the Yipes story as well. Getting back to the setup, I just love the page so much with the electronic brain.
It's fantastic.
Because the little prologue to it is that Scrooge is so delighted by the process that he asks Gyro if he can take a look inside and see the circuitry. And what does he discover there, Nils?
And Scrooge is also jumping up and down, so he's more than excited. But then he discovers that the full ChatGPT machine anno 1959 is the little helper listening and putting out the answers in real time. So it's a fantastic little thing. And it also has Scrooge wondering. Sometimes I wonder about that Gyro Gilus. I really do. So in the Norwegian version, it's something like, how smart is he really?
Well, I'll tell you, that panel, I am grateful that this story was completed just for that panel.
Yes. No, it's fantastic.
It is. I'm just going to tip my hat. This is by far my favorite panel of the entire story. I think it's one of my favorite panels that Barks ever did, to be honest, because I think about this panel a lot. It's what you would call in English. We have a term, an expression called the 1,000-yard stare. Yes. I don't know if you're familiar with that term,
but that's, I don't know.
Yes. That kind of vacant look that Scrooge is giving. That's what that's what that is. And it just cracks me up. Yeah. But at any rate, we have now the inventing sequence, which I think is another delightful page. It's my another of the parts of the story I really like. The idea here is that Gyro is inventing a cheese so potent that it has to be done in an airtight facility. And he's going to bring it back to Scrooge in this little sealed container where he can release tiny little bits of the tempting aroma as needed.
Yes.
We get just the first couple of panels of him. He returns to Scrooge in his bin, right? And he says that he's ready to go. Scrooge has opened the windows and he starts to tempt the rats and he sings a little ditty. I'm not sure if that is based on a specific piece of music. Do you know, Nils?
No, I don't think so. And yeah. If it had been the intention, I would have noticed, so to speak. So it's simply ditty.
Yeah.
But in the Rosa version, interestingly, we see a so-called forbidden character, namely Raptus von Rupp in Scandinavian. Ludwig van Drake is suddenly showing his face on page 4.
Right.
After, as I understand it, Rosa was told specifically, don't mention him. Don't mention the war. Don't mention Ludwig van Drake.
Yeah, and I think he was told that by the Dutch publisher, right? They had rule against him appearing. He's not essentially considered like a Barks canon character.
No.
Even though Barks did, I think, use him in just one brief comic called Flowers Are Flowers in 1964.
Yes.
So yeah, that's it for the Barks segment of the story. It's gonna This is where it's gonna diverge. Oh, you know what? I almost forgot to mention the one concession that Rosa made here in his story. He wanted to keep everything that Barks did totally intact, except that he does mention he didn't like that that this was one of the times that Barks didn't really care about where the money bin was. Uh-huh. Sometimes he depicted the bin like downtown. But Rosa, in his stories, he really likes it to be up on Kilmotor Hill.
So he manages to bring it back there, so to speak.
Right, because he wanted to end on that hill. So he changes one bit of dialogue to say that this is my overflow money bin, so to speak, so that he can kind of square that circle.
Yes. Famously, Duckburg and so on is place on Earth where we are able to and where we might square the circles.
Yes.
Because if we demand 99.9% consistency throughout, then it destroys too many interesting things.
Right. Well, it's one of the big differences between Barks and Rosa, right? Is that,
of course,
Barks did not care about continuity, and it's very important to Don Rosa.
Yes.
Yeah.
All means.
So at this point is where the story diverges, right? We're going to get our two versions. It's going to be Rosa's vision and then Don Yippus's vision. I guess the question here, Nils, is about the choices that they made and kind of the different storytelling styles of the two different artists. I also wonder, I remember as a kid that when I initially read this, it didn't clock for me that this was two artists doing the same story. You know, I felt like it was actually a pretty seamless transition.
Yes, I said to him. So I agree. And given the task, so to speak, here are three pages, 1-3. Please complete. I think both artists are delivering excellent solutions to that with their own different versions of creative details and so on and so on. So both stories are fully satisfactory given the task.
Yeah, I agree. I think they both stepped up and completed the assignment pretty well. There are definitely like
small criticisms that I could make, but it's almost not fair given the assignment. And these were assignments, you know, that they were requested to do. There is no right answer, right, when you have an unfinished story. So from a narrative point of view, but we'll save some of that for the reflection. As far as the Rosa story goes, you mentioned that we get this sequence where Rosa is gonna kind of organically continue the increasing amount of rats following Gyro. I really like the panel you alluded to that's downtown where we see Von Drake Laboratories. it's a very funny bit for Rosa that all of the five shops that he shows in that sequence are all ones that would have reasons for a lot of mice, a lot of rodents to be present.
Including books.
Yeah. Indeed. Booksellers famously hate mice and rats. Von Drake Laboratories certainly does some animal testing. And then Rosa keeps up the habit of having these kind of very expressive and happy, cute looking rodents.
Yes, they're pretty cute still. Until we slowly become afraid of them, they're pretty cute and adorable.
Right. And pretty quickly on that next page, he is going to arrive at the bridge to the Goose River. And as he says, not a moment too soon. Once the rats are across, he's going to blow it up with some nitro gear lucerin, which is fun little bit. And then here's a sequence that felt very natural to me. There's a police officer there who asks what he's up to, and he explains he's just going to blow up the bridge once the rodents are passed.
Tall order.
And the police officer exclaims, "You can't destroy this bridge. It's city property." And Gyro kind of glares up at his helper, saying, "Why didn't my electronic question answerer think of that small detail?"
Yes. So. Isn't that an American expression that he passes the buck?
Yeah.
He blames the little helper for not having thought about that.
He does. And I like that. I think it's a nice bit of payoff to something that the reader might have been wondering, when it was first exclaimed by Barks in his introduction.
Yes.
Wait, you can't just blow up the bridge.
No.
So I actually dare to say that it's entirely possible Barks might have had an exchange like this planned. Like, what do you mean you're going to blow up the bridge? And that's how you can take the rats essentially somewhere else.
Yes. So it's a beautiful part of the general storytelling that he doesn't spoil these later points by addressing all of these things too quickly in the story. So first we buy the concept of doing something on the bridge, either lifting it up for a bribe element in Dan Yippe's version or actually blowing it up dramatically.
Right.
So we swallow that on the first pages before we go on. And then a police officer enters the train and says, "You can't do that."
And so here's where Gyro is going to basically lose control, right? Because he's stopped for too long talking with this police officer. The rats have all collected. And the police officer is directing them away. And he thinks, I need to have Mr. McDuck by the bridge before he can carry out his plan.
Yes.
This exchange. Nils, does this stand out? Does this register in your translation that the police officer is a little bit of a stereotype of the Irish cop?
Yes, sort of. It's not an important component, I would say, but it does sort of match the situation. And his clothes are eaten up very quickly in one panel, etc. So,
as you say, it's
perfectly
it's not
adequate
important.
For the story. No.
Right. It's not important, but it was a pretty common stereotype in the time that Rosa is trying to represent the story. I really like this element where Rosa has Gyro do this U-turn and go back to the McDuck office. You know, he gets directed away. Gyro is directed away by Scrooge's clerks who say that he went to his regular money bin. So that also gives him the chance to kind of address, to again remind, this is just the overflow bin.
Yes.
But I really like that I like Rose's choice here where he brings Scrooge back into the story.
Absolutely. And time is rushing away. So this is really now the appropriate segment of the readership is now in a state of moderate panic.
Yeah.
For all the good reasons.
Both
so it's really
artists.
A nice escalation, a crescendo of the storytelling. Now time is of the utmost importance and what will happen and the rats are there still, etc. They're not yet piped away.
I agree. It's a good choice. Both artists make the good choice to have this story be very fast paced, very urgent.
Yes.
It's a constant emergency.
Yes.
And so we do flash at this point back to Scrooge for kind of the wrap up of Rose's version of the story, where he is in his bin. He doesn't have any reason to think that anything's gone wrong. He's listening to a news report on the old time, a very old fashioned looking radio talking about rats pouring in from Quackville, Pickleburg, other nearby towns. And he does not panic until he ponders, as long as he doesn't show up here. And then he gets a little buzz from Miss Quackfaster on his intercom, who informs him.
Faints very appropriately. She faints in a couple of panels.
Very classic gag. She informs him, "A Mr. Gearloose to see you, sir." And we just get the needed exchange where Gyro is explaining he needs money to buy the bridge. There's a funny gag where Scrooge says that, they're charging tolls now for rats. But
yes.
And you mentioned it. Miss Quackfaster fainting is a good way to introduce what the reader knows is coming. Which is that the rats have all caught up to the money bin and they have surrounded it.
So that's a lovely occasion for Don Rosa and his mindset to draw on a full, splendid half page. The thousands and thousands of rats, etc. So Scrooge, usually rather quick-minded, took some time to get into the appropriate panicky state of mind. But now he is in panicking too.
Yeah, and you know, in the Bark stories, I think rats in his bin is one of the things that is most reliable to cause him to panic. This is a fun half-page splash, right? Rosa says that he was pretty eager. It's the kind of thing that he is obsessive about, where Bark's at this point in his career. Maybe we can trust his memory, maybe not, but we know sometimes he was a little weary of drawing a lot of one thing. Rosa does sneak in one of his little trademark visual references. There's a little silhouette of Mickey Mouse
mixed in.
He doesn't like to do mouse. He had no interest in doing mouse stories, but he liked to sneak him in where he could.
Yeah, it's a classic little detail.
I also like how Scrooge kind of collapses over the fainted Miss Quackfaster.
Poor Miss Quackfaster.
So tell us, Niels, what does Gyro resort to? There seems to be no other choice here, right?
So he mixes it with the water to thin out the fabulous magical mythic cheese to make it weaker. Which sort of works, but it backfires too. So at the end of the story, no spoiler here, everything is eaten around the money bin on Kilometer Hill, apart from the money bin on top. So this looks for, it might be missing a giant golf player.
Right.
So that's the crux of the Don Rosa ending of the story.
Exactly.
So it's logical. And the rats behave like the rats are supposed to do, etc., etc. So everything is neatly consistent in that storytelling. Absolutely.
Yeah, I like this ending. The way this plays out, I like that he is kind of naturally referring back to how incredibly enticing his invented cheese is, right? They smell it through the ground, through the plumbing. And when they frantically chew their way through the ground, it leaves the bin completely on this almost pillar of earth, balanced very precariously. It looks like a golf ball queued up on a tee. And I like that it pulls back and reveals that as the very last panel. and how Gyro was looking very blasé and thinking that it wrapped up pretty well. It's a pretty ridiculous gag, right? What does he say? Yes. He says,
It pulls it off beautiful, and it's a beautiful ending. And of course, readers might ask what happens the day after, but that is not part of the storytelling. So we can leave it at that. And the same with the Dunleavy's solution, by the way.
Yeah, it's a gag story, so he doesn't have to worry about the consequences. He says, I just had an unsettling daydream about a giant with a huge golf club. So Rosa doesn't seem very satisfied with his own ending, if you read his commentary.
No, but that might be one of Don Rosa's also usual ways of downplaying his own art occasionally. But I think it's a splendid solution to the assignment, so to speak. Given the start, please continue the story and make it into an interesting story. And I think it's a beautiful solution.
Yeah, I like it as well. I actually asked him about it once at a con when I used up some of my precious time while he was signing something, just to ask him, because I knew I would come to this story at some point.
Yes.
And he reiterated that, and again, he was just kind of casually talking. This is not from any like official source or anything that he published thoughtfully. But he told me that he didn't really, because I asked if he remembered whether he really kind of pondered, you know, if it gave him pause, the idea of continuing a Bark story, right?
Yes.
Not just doing a sequel as he had done, but actually finishing one. And he just said, no, you know, it was an assignment. It was an editorial assignment. So apart from fulfilling kind of the parameters of the assignment, he didn't give it much thought. But he did mention that he didn't really care for, not that he disliked how he ended it. He just felt like it was something that he wasn't wholly satisfied with the ending. But as you say, he is often self-deprecating about what he does. I like the ending quite a bit. I think it's very clever and it's visually striking, which I really like.
So rereading the story yesterday, I did not at any point feel this should have been dealt with differently or proceeded in a different direction or whatever. So I think it's a beautiful, tight, well-told story.
Right. And I said kind of at the outset that I wasn't too interested in comparing these two stories. No. I think they're both successful. The one thing that I do like about Rose's choice, I do really like how he kind of closes the circle here. And he returns it to Scrooge and the bin effectively. And I do really like the almost blowing up the bridge sequence.
Yes.
I think that's a really very funny, very successful payoff. It is my hunch, though, that Don Yippis wouldn't have been allowed to even do that.
Perfectly possible.
Quote, post-September 11th the mid-2000s.
Yes. This is 2007, of course.
Right.
But I agree, there is an important nuance between, after all, being instructed to blow up a bridge or to pay the bridge person, which also sort of backfires. So it isn't quite as easy in the Netherlands either.
Let's transition. This is almost a fork in the road moment, an alternate reality. We're going to go back to the end of Bark's story and kind of resume where he left off. But I will note briefly, the one thing that stands out to me is the art that Rosa and Yippis, they finished it in different manners, right? Because I think that Rosa, when he was inking these first three pages, to me, it just looks like he took really great care to essentially preserve Bark's pencil lines as is, where he could.
And of course, Don Yippis was a person able to and used to doing precisely that, because he had done that with many other stories, penciling, etc. So, of course, case in point, here he is very careful. So it looks, the first three pages of the Don Yippis story, they look Barksian in quality of drawing and inking.
Yeah, they do. But I also noticed that some of the expressions look a little bit more changed relative to either, I'm not sure if it's relative to what Rosa did or relative to Bark's pencils. But I've read this so many times that I was like, wow, that really does look different to me. Not that it doesn't look Barksian, because of course Yip is famously, like, you know, he inserted a couple of the panels in Back to the Klondike that were missing.
Yes,
very convincingly.
Absolutely.
But I did notice, you know, they do different, very different eyes, for example. So
yes,
some of the moments do look a little bit different. And like, for example, I think Rose's version of that 1,000-yard stare, I think that does register a little bit different and has a little bit more of an impact for me.
Yes.
But at any rate, you're right. They probably, on the whole, look more Barksian, and probably there is more continuity between them in the Yippus.
Mm.
So the story does diverge right away. Yippus is going to take us to that bridge very quickly. And what we're going to see is that the bridge is in its raised position.
Because there's a boat there. So that clashes with plan A.
Right.
So in both stories, we are somehow naturally pushed to plan B, plan C, plan D for this enormous adventure.
This particular incident is
the fact that a big boat is coming at precisely that moment. So that makes plan A not go through.
Right. Exactly. I like that panel where the rats are kind of cavorting and gambling with and playing with Scrooge's money while he's unbothered, you know, because he expects them to leave really soon.
Yes. That's a lovely detail.
It is. I like how frantic Gyro gets at this moment, you know, begging the bridge master to open it. And we just get the cheese is going to accidentally hook onto the bridge's mast. I will note that I suspect this kind of bridge is something that is much more common in Scandinavia as well as Holland.
Absolutely. So we're used to that. I don't know. It might depend on which state you are living in the US, etc. But we are very used to such bridges being lifted and etc. Complete with a bridge person.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that they don't exist in the US, because we do have them, but they are very uncommon. But, you know, this is a common trope in even American stuff. If you need a bridge to lift, it's going to lift. So, you know, finally, the bridge master is able to, quote, accommodate him, but it's too late. Gyro says it's water under the bridge, and he has to follow the rats, now following this yacht.
Yes. So the many clever wordplays on fixed expressions like river under the bridge is perfectly adequate, and follow the cheese, and so on and so on.
Right. And so in order to unhook the cheese, he's going to rush to a helicopter rental service. And we do get a pretty cool panel of kind of the flood of rats from Gyro's perspective on the helicopter. As he's trying to reach down and grab that potent cheese, they do a neat little immediate U-turn, and he's going to go back now to the bridge, which is in the downward position.
Yes.
And at this time, he tries to raise the bridge to follow, you know, the deal that he made with him. You're supposed to raise it quickly once the rats. But the bridge master, he really should have been brought in on this plan ahead of time, I'm guessing.
No, I agree. Absolutely.
Because he raises the bridge comically fast. And he flings the cheese, and Gyro ponders, uh-oh, I wonder whose backyard it's going to land into. And of course, in some perfect comic logic, some poetic justice, it lands. Where does it land, Nils?
Yes, at Uncle Scrooge's place, of course, close to the money bin. So again, as you say, it's both poetic justice and perfect Duckburg logic that it must happen like this.
Right. Exactly.
And it's also interesting to see that poor Gyro is in a state here of continuous panic, page after page. So he's really in a panicky state, and he runs here and there, and he immediately sketches plan C, D, E, etc. when needed. And there's a helicopter just in time. So it's a hectic day at work for him.
Definitely. And it even hits poor Scrooge right in the head. So, you know, we do return to Scrooge. Yippus is squaring, or he is completing that circle. But Gyro and Scrooge never kind of reunite at the end, right?
No.
And I do feel like the ending is a little bit abrupt, because I think the last panel, the last big panel with the rats flooding into the bin, I think that's a wonderful panel. I love it.
Absolutely.
But I do, when I was reading it, the very last panel did not necessarily signal to me that it was the end of the story. You know, felt like it ended kind of abruptly, right?
It's a little bit cheap ending. It's not as literally satisfactory, possibly, as Don Rosa's version is.
Right.
Because then the ending is more natural and you feel as a reader, this is the way the story ended. Good.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the ending is quite as satisfying. I don't want to downplay I think it's a very successful, right? It's a successful version of the story.
No, it's a super solution to the assignment, to call it in school teacher terms.
And even if Rosa's story, the ending is a little bit outlandish, it does feel very satisfying to me.
Yes.
So that's it. You know, the both artists have completed this. It was a really big assignment, essentially. Even if it's a short story and it's only 5 pages to do, I think it's a pretty imposing thing to ask either of these men.
Actually, the page number is 9 in total for the Don Yippus version versus the classical.
Right.
So there's one more page. Yes,
that's right. Thank you for correcting me. He does, and it actually feels a little bit longer, because Gyro goes through so much of this mayhem.
Panic,
I think it must have been important to Rosa to kind of stick with the quote, you know, proper length of a Gyro gear loose.
Yes, the formula with the 8.
Mm, right, yes. Exactly. Mm. So I really enjoy both versions. I'm not going to make any secret of the fact that I do prefer the Rosa one, but I can't really, I have to be honest, I read that version when I was 10 years old. I reread it many, many times.
The famous formative years.
Yeah, exactly. It was a formative story for me. And I didn't read the Yippus was only published in the States for the first time just a few months ago. So I read that very recently.
Yes.
What about you? What do you think of this story?
I think I agree with the general comments. And again, I will, as the prototypical teacher at school, give the highest marks to both favorite pupils. Both solutions are perfectly acceptable and wondrously creatively pulled off, so to speak. But I also side with Don Rosa's as being slightly more satisfactory regarding the ending. And whether it's 8 or 9 pages, should not be so important. But it's a beautifully told story with a beautiful ending point. And we might wonder what happens the day after in Scrooge's life and in Miss Quackfaster's life and in Duckburg, generally speaking. And they will be on the news, surely. But I think it's, and it belongs firmly in the Don Rosa list of works. So it's not a technical outlier in a serious sense of the word.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's probably fair also to mention for Yippus just the fact that Rosa's came first, right? So I think there's, by necessity, he's not going to do the same thing.
By all means.
Right. So he has to come up with something different. In that sense, he was telling like a different kind of story. It's this very madcap style that I think matches what Yippus likes to do. He likes this very kinetic, frantic style a lot.
Also in some of his stories with Freddy Milton, I recall. So it's that story universe of things.
Right, exactly. Just a brief look at how these are regarded by fans. You know, I like to check in on Index.
Good.
The quote original telling of this, the Pied Piper of Duckburg, gets a 7.2, which is ranked pretty well. It's number 663 out of all like 43,000 stories that have votes on Index. You know, the Rosa stories tend to get ranked pretty high, so I think there's probably a little bit of a fan element.
Bonus.
And the Yipus version isn't ranked nearly as highly. It's a 7.0 out of 10 with 4,000 some. But I mean, there are dramatically fewer votes and it's been around way less long. So,
of course,
again, I'm not really interested in comparing them.
No, we should be looking at these numbers, but they're not well calibrated barometers, so to speak. So,
right. Especially when there's only been about 20 votes for the Yipus version. Do you have, so I mentioned, I like to wrap up talking about favorite panels. And I mentioned that that 1,000-yard stare one of Mark's as finished by Rosa is by far my favorite in this story. And it's honestly, it's one of my favorite Disney Comics panels of all time. Is there, what would be your favorite maybe from that three pages, indeed, that Mark did.
I like page two very much because of this odd thing happening here, which is both fantastic but also slightly disturbing. If we are to believe for the future of our Duckburg readings that that Gyro is only moderately smart, but that it is little helper doing all the super thinking, that would be a little bit too much of a stretch, and possibly I don't like it so much. But also I like the presence of Ludwig van Dijk on page four, and I like poor Miss Cockfaster.
Yes. Yeah, that's a
good one. Has a difficult day at work.
Yeah, she definitely gets.
But luckily, and she's coming to on the last page.
Yeah.
With words like, "What is happening here?" After having been on the floor for two consecutive pages.
Right. One imagines that she's probably got another fainting spell ahead of her when she realizes. What's happened. Yeah, I do like that Ludwig von Drake. I really like that character. Rosa has mentioned that he really wanted to like integrate him into the Duck family tree, for example.
Yes.
But he had to kind of keep that as an unofficial thing they just, for whatever reason, they didn't want him in those stories. What about, did you have a, I'll mention my favorite panel from the Rosa segment. The Roses only sequence. So I do like that final panel with the kind of golf club formation. But I think the panel where Gyro is pressed against the McDuck office with his clerks just staring in horror at those rats is very funny. And I like that one a lot as well.
I do like the cop scene too, whether he is clearly an Irish cop of the 1959 era or not. So it's part of the storytelling, and I like his presence and his attitude in the story. So without that, the story would not have been flowing as well if the cop hadn't tried to stop him from blowing up the bridge.
Right. That's a very funny bit. What about the Yipus version? Is there a panel from his segment that you would consider a favorite?
Of course, I do like the drama of the little helper jumping like an action movie from the helicopter to grab the peas with the word pluck, exclamation mark, etc.
Yeah.
So I like it very much, even though it possibly doesn't qualify as top ever type panels. But again, as a reader of these nine Dan Yipus pages, I like the story, I give the higher mark, but there are no super favorite panels to pay attention to, so to speak. It's a good story, well told, and it ends like it ends, with a little bit cheap ending. But possibly I'm too harsh by looking at the pages now and thinking aloud that there are no super panels that jump out at you.
Yeah, I think I'm aligned with you. None of the panels really stands out that much for me, other than the ending, the near ending with the rats pouring in. It's a big panel, so it's very nice. Although I will say I do like all of the different angles that Yipus is using in the like helicopter pursuit. There are some great angles that you don't points of view perspective that you don't often see in these Dutch in these in these Disney comics. So that stands out.
It's partly like your prototypical American Mission Impossible action film with scenes of that type.
Right.
Because and it I is a Mission Impossible here too.
Yes. Definitely what he's going for. Well, thank you so much, Nils. I really appreciate you joining me to digest this. This is a pretty unusual conversation,
Mark.
But I think we this was a lot of fun, and I really appreciate it.
And I will send you my favorite recording of the Goethe song with Hugo Wolf.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll look forward to that. Hopefully I can integrate
The Rattenfänger.
Nice. Well, thank you again. I would invite people to check us out for our next episode of both Barks Remarks and Rosa Remarks, and they can follow us on Facebook and sometimes on Instagram. I know that you post a lot under the Donaldist group on Facebook
in
Norway. Yes.
Yes. So that's a pretty active group, actually. So with lots of conversations and good people around to throw in new elements, etc. So that's a well-working Facebook group.
Right. All right. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.